Compassion, as I see it, is the catalyst that brings purpose to life, amplifies the impact of strengths, and creates a culture where people feel seen, valued, and empowered.
Welcome to the
thing. Awesome.
Woo! All right. Okay. Welcome to the Thriveology Lab podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Phil Dunwoody, that's me,
and Neil Lutterbach, that's me. Phil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. Before we get started, Phil, where can folks find us?
Everywhere. Subscribe to Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube and we'll be sure to respond. And be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook and also LinkedIn. You can also reach us via email at thriveologylab@gmail.com.
So today's episode, we are thrilled to have an interview with Lars Kure Juhl. Lars Kure Juhl facilitates organizational happiness and the on-site workshop Positive Leadership for UPEACE Center for Executive Education at the University for Peace in Costa Rica, my favorite place on the planet. Lars is an international trusted advisor, HR executive, and talent management expert working out of Copenhagen with a wide range of leaders, international organizations, and institutions across the globe. Lars' educational background consists of a Master's of Law from University of Copenhagen and HR Leadership and Talent Management from INSEAD and Harvard Business School. His 2019 book, Organizational Happiness, became a number one international bestseller on Amazon. It's a book for leaders and HR practitioners on creating a unique competitive advantage with focus on purpose, strengths, and compassion, what he calls the happiness sweet spot. His new book, Compassion in Action, A Leadership Paradigm That Cultivates Organizational Happiness, was published this year and builds upon organizational happiness. In it, Lars writes, "Compassion in Action is the applied methodology that brings organizational happiness to life, making it tangible, measurable, and actionable."
We're thrilled to have Lars on the program today. Lars and I have known each other for a few years now. I had the pleasure of meeting you at the Gross Global Happiness Summit at University for Peace in Costa Rica. I took an organizational happiness class with you through University for Peace. And I use your first book on this, Organizational Happiness, in a graduate class I teach on organizational psychology. And I'm a big fan of your work. You have one of your quotes is something like complexity is the enemy of application, or I'm paraphrasing. And I think you do a really nice job of kind of taking a large literature that is complicated and boiling it down to nice, easy to remember things that can be applied for leaders. You write, "I believe that the key to a happier and more successful society is the cultivation and growth of compassion at every level, individual, organizational, and national. And it starts with taking the lead and striving for it." And I know you as someone who, you know, you live this, right? I mean, it seems that this is your heart work, if you will. So I want to say thank you for everything you do and welcome to the program.
Welcome.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the kind words. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to an interesting conversation.
So why don't we start briefly? So you have these two books, Organizational Happiness, and then I'm going to call it the sequel, Compassion in Action. How would you describe the relationship between these books?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I published the book in 19, the Organizational Happiness, including a model. I think maybe we can talk about that later. But
yeah.
But one of the areas that I focused on in 2019 was compassion. And, you know, I thought that was easy. It was like dive into compassion and give a little how-to on that, and you become a better leader. But then, you know, a lot of things happened after 2019. But also, I think I became a wiser man, because when I talked with leaders about compassion, or when I initiated a conversation with organizational leaders about compassion, they started talking about self-compassion. And which was interesting, and it was a surprise for me, actually. I didn't expect that. So it kind of started a journey, and I think we talked about it, Phil, at some point.
We did. Yes. Yeah. As to whether or not self-compassion was necessary for other compassion. I think that was part of our conversation.
That's right. I think maybe we can touch on that. I think that's interesting. But for me, it was like I opened up a new Pandora's box called compassion. And I thought it was simple. It was not simple. But I wanted to offer leaders and organization a way to cultivate a culture of compassion. I don't think I did a good enough job in the first book with that. I just touched or scratched the surface on the compassion side. So I wanted to dive deeper into that, you know, so compassion as an enabler for leaders to create what I call organizational happiness or thriving organizations. You can use many words for happiness, right, in organizations. So that was kind of that sequence. So I had that message. I wanted to get out there at some point.
And Lars, there's so much to unpack in what you just said, but you mentioned that model that you lay out. Can you briefly explain what the model is?
Yeah, so in my book Organizational Happiness, I introduce first the science of happiness, and I also I'm a big fan of, you know, Dr. Martin Seligman, who kind of he invented the PERMA model, right? I think in his book from 2012, Flourish. He kind of shared that model. So I think that's kind of the basic or easy way to understand the science of happiness, if you want a simple model for that. And for me, I'm a practitioner. I take a pride in being a practitioner, not a professor, but a practitioner with leaders and organizations. For me, I wanted to take that. How can I bring some of that? How can I bring that power, the power of happiness, into leadership and organizations? So I developed on that research, on that basis, I developed a model called the Happiness Sweet Spot, which consists of three pillars. It's purpose. You know, I think one of the best thought leaders on this purpose is Simon Sinek, talking about why.
Start with why.
Yeah, the power of why, or start with why. But that basically for organization, what is it? Why are you here? Something that is more a heartfelt purpose that is more than profit. Sometimes we call it the employer value proposition. We call it many things, but as an organization, you need to work on your purpose. And we can talk about why, but that's the first part. The second pillar of the happiness sweet spot is strength-based leadership, which is basically about what's your superpower and how can you bring that into play in the organization. We can talk more about that, but I think there is our upbringing in the corporate world very often, including myself, the way I'm brought up in the corporate world is we have the yearly performance review, and it usually ends with a conversation about what is it that you're not so good at, that you need to spend more time and resources at to be just a little bit better, right? I think that's a losing strategy. I think the winning strategy is talking about what's your superpower, how can I help you bring that more into play in our organization or create the circumstances. So that's the second pillar. The third pillar is compassion. which is really about how do we or how can we cultivate a culture of compassion in our organization. So that's the three pillars: purpose, strength, compassion. And it's not a one-size-fits-all model. It's more like you can dive into it and see, where am I as an organization? Where would I like to put more emphasis? Where should I spend my time and resources to find that sweet spot between those three pillars?
Yeah, and as you mentioned, this is based on a lot of research in positive psychology, Seligman's being some of it, but there's a good bit of research on performance evaluations and how the deficit focus actually causes disengagement in employees, that they don't actually get better on those things, even when you point them out. And it does make more sense to focus on, okay, what are your strengths and how can we utilize you more in that position that leverages your strengths the best?
That's right. And it sounds easy when we have this shorter conversation about what to do. And that we can easily present a model where you use or you subscribe to strengths-based leadership, but mm-hmm. it's almost like it's crazy that we're still doing it, still investing our time, resources, our money into just getting a little bit better at something we are not really good at. It will never be a winning strategy, and to change that conversation is not easy in an established organization. So when I work with more established, mature organization, it's like a culture we talk about. We put language on it, like areas for development or improvement. Yep. I don't know what, so something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And this, the culture part, I think, is huge, because there is not just culture, but then, some of the culture comes from the values that leadership project. That's an aspect of how culture is shaped. And one of the things I've run across in talking with leaders about workplace well-being, there are a couple things. One, they think of it as well-being programs that are, I'll say, kind of very HR budget-oriented. And it's not really about how does your role contribute to the purpose of the organization, and how do you see that purpose in a meaningful way, right? That's a big picture drive for human motivation. And there's also sometimes a dismissiveness that, like, well, some people just maybe aren't tough enough. They take well-being, workplace well-being, this focus to say, compassion and relationships. And occasionally I get leaders who kind of, I would say, they almost don't think it's their job. They're like, well, if you're not tough enough to hack it, then maybe you should go somewhere else and we'll find someone who's better. And so to me, it doesn't jive with how I think about the world. And certainly not with what you're writing. But I guess my question coming out of this is how do you talk with leaders? I did a workshop recently where I had some people who they got the problem as soon as I started talking and they wanted to jump to solutions. And other people who were completely skeptical that this was even a real problem, essentially talking about burnout and workplace well-being. And I see those as two sides of the same coin. Because if you look at the research, the things that enhance workplace well-being and thriving are the opposite of the things that cause burnout.
That's right.
So how do you message and deal with leaders knowing that there's this huge continuum of how they view their sympathy to this topic to start with?
Yeah, I think that's important, and I think that's an important question and an important consideration, because I think also what you're doing in a podcast like this, I mean, building that is also, we are all still a little bit of, change makers in a space, obviously we can call it happiness, wellness, thriving, whatever words we're using. And very often we, so when we meet in Costa Rica, we you know, sometimes we get our energy from being in an echo chamber almost with like-minded people, right?
Yeah.
And we talk about it. Everybody gets it. But it's like we are preaching to the choir, right? So I think the real test, and this is where I when I said I take a pride in being a practitioner, so, you know, I have a corporate career, and sometimes I have to put on my nice clothes and my suit and even a tie and step into that boardroom and talk about happiness, which is, I mean, some of the experiences I had, it's not always easy. I think there is more and more, it resonates more and more for various reasons. We can talk about that maybe, but I think being able to step into the boardroom or the senior executive management meeting and talk about happiness and use the language that we use in organizations or in that organization, which is like, what's the business case? What are the KPIs? Mm-hmm. How are you? And sometimes you need to do that language.
Yeah, what's the return on investment?
To drive the process. And sometimes you get kicked out. And I mean, you can feel it within 5 minutes, right? It's like, if it resonates or not.
And part of the what I think I'm also hearing is like sort of similar to what Phil was talking about, the sort of surface level, like I understand it conceptually that this is beneficial, but then when I try to put it into practice or change that culture, there's a kind of disconnect or dissonance between those two. And so why is it so difficult when you're in those boardrooms, what's the disconnect between putting the pieces together for people, do you think?
Because it's complex, I think it's like, so you know, 5 years ago, when or six maybe when I published the book, we had these difficult conversations. I think, and even before that, we worked with organizational happiness, but I think now it's becoming more and more mainstream. You have companies like McKinsey; they're starting to talk about happiness. They're starting to talk about organizational health is something they talk about. I don't want to get into that, but you know, and I think some of that storytelling makes it, like you said, Neil, that okay, I get it. It might be something I need to spend time on to understand, and then sometimes they invite someone like me to tell about what is it and what can we do. But the science of happiness is complex. And you said it, Phil, one of the things that I'm saying is like, and complexity is the enemy of execution.
Mm-hmm.
And if you apply something that is complex on an organization, and you know, an organization is also a complex organism. It's almost like the gearing in the complexity. It gets so crazy that it becomes something you just talk about because you cannot change the real behavior. And this is where I think that why the book is popular and some of the organizations we're working with are happy with that, is like give you a little bit of a enabling platform, I would call it, stand on a platform that gives you an ability to change behavior in the organization. And it's almost like we need that from strategy to action. And this model, and even the book I published in March, also tries to give some of that enabling framework so you can start taking the first step, right? And know how to take the step.
Yeah. And it's a really good framework that way. The resistance that I see, I would describe it as kind of tough-mindedness, this kind of old school, well, you're going to sink or swim, and that's not really my fault. My job is to get this work done. And, you know, I think of how our role as educators has changed. And that used to be kind of the model in the classroom. You know, I give the material as the professor, and then I test you on it, and you succeed or you don't, and that's not really my fault. And really, the model has switched to say, well, and even the research shows that the really well-prepared students, they're going to succeed no matter what I do. And it's really the rest of the students that I'm really going to impact by showing, for example, that I care about their success, that I actually want them to do well. And instead of blaming them for their failure, thinking about how I, as an educator, how can I cultivate an environment in the classroom that best facilitates their learning? And that's the same thing. That's the same way I view this leadership around compassion, for example. You can take this tough-minded approach of, well, look, our business is just stressful and you can either make it or you cannot. In which case, I mean, yeah, people are going to weed out that way. Or you can say, I want to make the best use of the people I have. You use the phrase, what I really like, Lars, this releasing potential, yeah. Right? Releasing human potential. And I think that's because it implies that it's already there, and I'm just kind of working on the conditions that allow it to be expressed as a leader. And I wonder if you could talk about kind of why you use that phrase and what it means to you.
Yeah, and it reminds me, you know, that toughness, I think we need to get past that somehow. And sometimes we can talk a little bit about leadership a little later, maybe, you know, what is effective leadership? Because I think you need to realize that what some people that you refer to think about when if you can convince, these are mostly men, I would say, if I think about it. But if you can convince them to say, what's the most effective leadership style you can have? It's actually compassionate leadership, right? We can talk more about that, but somehow you need to convince organization leaders about that, because then you can start working with it. Because I want to be effective as leader, right? I want to be successful. So sometimes I adopt the style that is most effective. And I think that speaks to the case here. So, but coming back to your original question, Phil, so releasing or unlocking potential, I like that, because the way I see both human beings and organizations, human beings in organizations, is that it's already there. Mm-hmm. It's in me. We as leaders, we just need to unlock it or release it. And there's so many, you know, different ways of doing that as leaders. Organization culture is one of them. We talked about well-being programs. I'll get back to that a little bit, if I may. But sometimes a metaphor helps, right? And sometimes I see it as a, you know, the popcorn. The corn that is not popped yet, right? You put it into a microwave and you start heating. And that could be a long story. So, but in my home, we know exactly how much it needs heating before it starts to pop, right? But if you see the organization as a corn there, or each individual as a corn, at some point I pop. And I think that should be our ambition, you know, and that's because someone heated me. Could be energy, leadership, culture, whatever you put into that. Communication is also a big thing into that. But we want to have individuals in our organization that are popped. Mm-hmm. As I see that as someone who has unlocked their potential. And that's what we want more. And if you're not able to do it in my organization, we might help you to be popped somewhere else, because I think it's a responsibility to take care of that well-being, right, of our employees.
And I think that idea of of fullness already, sort of intrinsic fullness, is so important in creating some of that cultural, that environment. I teach, much of my teaching is also in theater. So I'm very much about interested in how to cultivate sort of curiosity and creativity. And what I see time and time again, like if students feel like they are lacking something, or they're afraid to expand what is already there, to release what they already had as children, right? Yeah. You are born with this, you already have it. I don't need to teach you anything. My job is really to sort of uncover all the BS that's been built up over those years, because you're already, you already have everything about that. And if that that environment is not created in the studio, those students are very closed off. They're very afraid to take risks. They're fearful of shame, of humiliation. And that is just a recipe for stagnation or even regression. Like they just sort of close off on themselves. So, you know, as a teacher leader in that room, part of what I need to do is just create the environment that allows them to already do what they are already capable of. And so I think, and you reference in the book the Project Aristotle from Google, where they sort of celebrate this risk taking without fear of retribution and fear. I wonder if you could sort of talk more about sort of maybe how leaders can sort of create those cultures. Maybe this is the leadership segue. Like what is leadership? What is good leadership? There's my question.
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, what is good leadership? And I like that. I like that notion, intrinsic fullness. I haven't, it's something I will remind myself.
You can steal it. It's yours now.
and you also speak to something before I answer the other question, or speak to that, but you also speak to that something I see in organizations, actually, what you probably see in that classroom or in the studio. It's also, if I, as a consultant, so I operate as a consultant very often, right? Or advisor or whatever you call it. But if I walk into the organization and say, we have a specific project here, it's called something, I don't know what you call this project, and it's about, we have to reinvent ourselves, and there will be a big disruption going on, right? What that does to an organization is almost exactly what you said, Neil, is that it kind of, everybody ducks a little bit. You get afraid. You're afraid to make decisions. You don't step into the fire, if you to use that. And the whole organization slows down in terms of productivity or whatever you're doing. So, and it's a totally different conversation if you step into that organization and say, we can do much more with what we have here. How can we together, leadership and organization, how can we create an environment where we feel that we use our strength for the purpose of our organization, right? Mm-hmm. And so the question was, and while I'm talking, I'm trying to think about a good answer, but it's like, what is good leadership? I think when you reference the Project Aristoteles from Google, right? And they talk about, one of the findings there was that the single most contributed to high performance in teams is psychological safety, right? They kind of coined that. And I think, so good leadership, I think it starts with, for my part, I think it starts with connection. And connection, if you speak to what Phil maybe have highlighted a couple of times, connections doesn't start with toughness. Mm-hmm. Or it doesn't start with me telling that I'm educated from Harvard Business School, or I used to be a CEO, or something like that. It doesn't start with that. Connections start with projecting warmth. So this is
compassion,
when
compassion, you might say.
What?
Compassion, you might say.
Compassion, you might say. But this is where the connect, and you know, so, and we know this, instead of presenting your credentials, if you're projecting warmth, we know that that is a lot more effective in terms of leadership, right? And there is a building block for, you know, connection, trust, and psychological safety. So there is, I mean, if you start the right place by building that connection, whatever, it also depends on your personality, of course, how you best do that. But I think that's good leadership and effective leadership. I also wanted to say in that I think good leadership has the thinking around good leadership, I think, is that we take care of the well-being of the people that we lead and serve. And in the serving part, it's also, I'm both leading and I'm also serving the people that I'm leading. Mm-hmm. Because we know that, I think that's a responsibility if you're a leader. You should take that responsibility to take care of the well-being. Both because it's almost like we spent 90,000 hours at work in a lifetime, right? It's a US study, but around 90,000 hours, right? Just thinking about that, I think we as leaders need to take care of the well-being of the people that we lead and serve. And then it's also a very good business case.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the basic things you're supposed to do is protect your assets. And and your people in the organization are a huge part of any organization's assets, right? And if they are burning out, if they are disengaged, quiet quitting, looking to leave, then you are not protecting your assets then as a leader. And you know, you mentioned the PERMA model. The R is relationships.
That's right.
We are social beings fundamentally, and that sense of psychological safety. You know, and that, what does that mean? It means that you can be yourself. It means you're accepted for who you are. You feel like you can share your opinion freely. You can say things that might be critical, you know, in a constructive way. If you're worried about being attacked, if you're worried about being thrown under the bus, being criticized, you're going to filter. Yeah. And we know that sense of threat, it inhibits creativity. And you think about, well, what do we want in our teams? What do we want in our organizations? We want creativity. We want new ideas, new ways. You talk about unlocking potential, right? Unlocking creativity. And that comes through this, I think, having people feel like they can be themselves, that they can share, so that they're not worried about what they say being used against them.
Yeah, and I think that also is like we find this problem in school and in teaching as well. Like, it's, you don't enter the classroom and suddenly you're a different person. You've compartmentalized somehow your being, and then you leave, and then you live the rest of your life. Like, all of the fullness of ourselves comes in both. Like, 90,000 hours, you said, like, that's that's a lot of my life in this space, and it's the fullness. And I think not only do I need the safety to be myself, but that fullness of myself as well. Yeah.
And I think that just mentioning that, I think what you both are touching on here is something that we are also working on in this context is what we call the belonging part, right? Mm-hmm. The power mm-hmm. of belonging.
Yes. Yes,
and
exactly.
And in organization, I see that as, you know, you're being seen. Mm-hmm. You said, I almost said that, Phil, being seen like the person that you are and what you bring to work. You are able to contribute, and you're proud of what you're doing and the family organizations you're a part of. So those three things kind of creates belonging. This is a longer conversation, I think, but I think it's so important because for you, as you said, Neil, as a human being there, that's important for you, for that you feel that most of the 90,000 hours, right, that you kind of belong somewhere. But it's also where retention and high performance in teams lives and reduce stress and burnout, right? So there are also some KPIs that you touch there that is a huge business case.
Yeah, and I think that some, you know, burnout got a whole lot of press around COVID and the year or two after COVID. But I think it is an underappreciated risk that organizations face because they don't realize how it inhibits engagement and essentially works against all of the things that they want in terms of engagement and productivity and creativity. And I mean, Gallup has a lot of research on this as well, yeah, and kind of how leaders can talk about burnout and recognize the symptoms and what to do about it. You've mentioned working as a consultant. I know you've worked with Boston Scientific as an example. I'll say I have a childhood best friend who works at Boston Scientific, and he has said it's the best organization he has ever worked with. Culturally, the way he feels valued and appreciated there, he will not voluntarily leave that company. But this is a huge thing, right? In terms of if you're a good organization, you want to be able to attract good people and retain good people. This is a huge part of what, you know, HR professionals and whatnot are focused on. So can you talk about either Boston Scientific or other organizations you've worked with, and specifically what do you do with them?
Yeah, so you know, being a practitioner, so what I often do is, like, you know, it can range from doing a keynote, making a half day workshop, making a 2 day workshop, to a year long. Working together, right? So it depends a little bit on the, I would call, intervention that we agree on. But with Boston Scientific, I think it's a very good example, and I think they are a lighthouse or role model in terms of implementing real well-being strategy. I mean, not just as a ping pong table, a lunch package, or mindfulness training, but it's a real strategic priority for them. So, and it speaks to a little bit what you asked about, Neil, in the beginning. How do you actually get from, I get it, it sounds nice, how do I actually do something about it? With Boston Scientific, we started in, I think it about 5 years ago, and I met them at a keynote or something like that, and they came up and wanted me to sign the book, but they want to tap into that power. They kind of decided, we want to be first mover here. We want to tap into that power. We are in a competitive environment with other, you know, attracting top talent, things like that. They had that conversation. How do we do that? And what we started with is that they selected a core team from different areas, HR, management, leadership, you know, quality, different people across the organization, and we brought them to Costa Rica, of course.
Mm-hmm. Of course,
magical.
On the top of the mountain, we spent 2 days on what we called scoping and training workshop. Mm-hmm. So we helped them scope. First, we trained a little bit in getting, how do you do this organizational happiness, compassion, action thing? And then we kind of helped each other scope our year-long process. And then they started. Then they went home, started to implement it. We backed up a little bit and with coaching and things like that. And we met all their leaders, all their top 100 leaders we met and also introduced this and made them walk away with a commitment on what to do in their organization when they got back home with their team.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of took it, you know, made a strategy, touched the top in the organization. And for them, and I think this is no secret, at least not now, but they started with purpose. They thought purpose, it was easy for them. You know, they make this life-saving medical devices,
yeah,
but they're not very good at telling it to the employees of the world, right? So they started creating that story. And then gradually they moved into compassion and last year, we worked a lot on the power of belonging with that mm-hmm. framework with all the managers. And what it, and you know, and I almost said it before that of course one thing we also did recently was, you know, they have the Boston Scientific have global well-being champions all over the world. It's a nice role to have, I think.
But yeah, what is that?
It's somewhat, you know, and they even have a global well-being strategy. And it's and at a company like Boston, it's both because you want to create an environment where people want to be. You said mm-hmm. that with your childhood best friend, right?
Yeah.
So you create that, but it's also that they know that at least these three KPIs, the high performance, the retention, and you can even just say something like you said, innovation, things like that, even though that's difficult to measure. But there are like at least five KPIs that you measure on after a project like this. And it's really interesting because they measure on everything, right? They're a big American company with a lot of KPIs.
I'm sure.
So you don't get to run projects like this unless you deliver on the KPIs, right?
So the training was based on the three, your model, it sounds like, the compassion, purpose, and strengths. Were they already measuring those KPIs before, or did they start doing that kind of with the training? Do you know?
Some of the KPIs they have already, or they had already, and in the beginning we also developed some 10 questions that you can ask on a regular basis to kind of track a little bit what's going on. Are we developing on how is the, we call it motivation landscape?
Yeah. So are those the, because you have those items in your, I believe they're in the book here.
They're in the book, yeah.
Yeah, so are those the items that they use?
Yeah, they use those 10 questions and, you know, asking organization on a regular basis. It could be every month, every 3 months, or they measure on a yearly basis. I think on that, many organizations, you know, measure something, happiness, satisfaction, engagement, whatever. And I think there is a point here. I think it's a little bit on the side of this, but I think it's important because you need to measure on these things also. But if you only do it once a year, you're kind of kidding yourself, right? Because you will be acting on old data for a whole year.
Mm-hmm.
You will be measuring a week. That week, you will be measuring the engagement and it will be my perception of my manager that week. And then 1 month out, or maybe 2 months out, you'll get the results from that week. And then the rest of the year, you will act like this is the current situation, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So I would argue, it could also be a longer conversation, but I would argue it's a waste of time to do yearly employee engagement surveys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I mean, there's a whole lot of, I do survey research myself, and there's a whole lot of subtlety in what that data says and how you should use it and whatnot. And the opposite can also be true, in that if you're asking questions about trust or confidence in leadership, and they say, well, you know, our scores didn't go up from last year to this year, even though we changed things. Well, people's perceptions don't always change that quickly either. So, you know, we have, once I form an impression of you, it's actually difficult to change that impression. So so these 10 items real quick here, because these are good. I'm going to read these real quick. I feel happy at work. I'm proud of being part of my organization. I know how I contribute to the mission of our organization. I would recommend a friend for a job here. I have the opportunity to do what I do best. I have the opportunities to learn, grow, and develop. I have the resources available that enable me to do a good job. I feel people care about me. I get recognition or praise. My opinion counts. And those really hit on the things, the strengths, compassion, and this sense of purpose.
Yeah.
And what I also hear in that list is, like, as I'm going through my own little mental checklist of like sometimes an organization can hit, we're really good at this. And then, we're not hitting so hard on this. And that it's that complexity thing. Like, it's a complex organization, a complex system. And sometimes you might be, and I think sometimes you hear leaders like, but we're doing so well at X. It's like, yeah, but like, Y is suffering over here. And where was I going? You sparked a question. Like, when those leaders, whether it's Boston Scientific or other organizations that come to you, like when you had those initial conversations, who were the people that had that spark? Was it high level? Was it mid level? Was it where do you see the spark needing to happen to set that fire?
Yeah. That's a good question. And I'm just going to piggyback on that briefly, because I get in the organizational leadership class, I get a lot of questions related to people's place in the hierarchy. And they may say things sometimes like, well, I'm not that high up, right? And the tone is being set differently above. So how do I execute on these things? Which is relate, right? Where do you need to be in this hierarchy to lead this change?
Yeah, so it's not a clear answer or a yes or no answer to that. I think, because sometimes you bump into a CEO or a chief human resource officer that kind of have both the authority and the budget and things like that to do things like this within the strategy. So that is sometimes what happens, and that is start a conversation and then move into how should this look like in my organization? What is it that we start doing, and how to change that behavior that we want to change? But I think very often it's also a course when we do the organizational happiness certification course at UPS, right? These are individuals, typically a little lower level. They are manager maybe, or they are managing a function somewhere in an organization or an NGO. And they kind of see this as an opportunity for their team and their organization. And sometimes they create a little lighthouse in the organization, and then of course I try to support and help the best I can. But if you're able to create that role model or lighthouse within your organization, this is a very solid road to change, right? I think so. So I try to facilitate that they take the responsibility of being change makers, and try to sell that in the organization by doing it. And sometimes it happens like that, and then it kind of ripple effect. It's quite powerful when it happens that way.
I love that approach, because just because those above you aren't leading that way doesn't mean you can't. It doesn't mean that you can't message and try and inspire to them and message inspire to those around you. This is, like I said, this is the question comes up in my in the class I teach, and that is also the message I give, and it's been my own experience, as an organizational leader, that of course I can't control what the people above me do. I mean, I can't control the people next to me or below me either, right? I mean, it's you want to inspire. I think that's what a lot of good leadership is inspiration. I'm going to read another quote from your book here. Many of the leaders I work with share a common sentiment. Compassion in action is not only transformational, it brings hope. Hope for workplaces that cultivate trust, belonging, and engagement. Hope for leaders who inspire, empower, and serve. Hope for a future where real leadership is defined by compassion, courage, authenticity, and human connection. And I think that so sums up a lot of kind of your approach to what leadership is. I don't know how much of this, I teach in an org leadership graduate program, and I'm teaching an organizational psychology class that draws a lot from the positive psychology literature. I mentioned we use your book. I don't know how common this is in, let's say, you know, MBA programs or other executive development programs. Do you have a sense of that? I mean, I know you lead this way, and because it would be nice if this became, if you will, standard practice.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. And that's how I live my life, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure it will, because, you know, it's I think, and I had this in an interview recently, I had this conversation. There is a shift happening, I think. There is a necessary shift happening, and I think it might be happening because it's necessary, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's and that is, I think, I'd sometimes say that the next big revolution is not technology driven, right? It's more humanity and compassion in leadership. And this goes on all levels, on nations. And I think it feels like, and maybe I'm just surrounding myself with people like that. but it feels, I believe that there is a revolution there at some point and I hope it will be in my lifetime, where we put more humanity and leadership, humanity and compassion into leadership. Because I don't think our problem are not really about technology. It's more moral, ethically, and things. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's that the fix. We can talk about organizations and burnout, things like that. We can talk about nations and that, but the fix is leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think I've said that often, like, COVID didn't so much cause problems as it did reveal structural problems. And I think AI or technology is similar. It's not the problem. It's showing us the problems in our sort of human disconnects. And the solution is not in the AI, it's in the compassion and the love we have for each other and our fellows.
And that's such a big shift from some, I'll say some leaders that, you know, sometimes the people who climb to the top would be accurately described as narcissists. And that's, they kind of by definition have a lack of empathy and compassion. I mean, it's part of the definition is that they see other people only as a means to an end. And, you know, you're basically, I use you to get what I want. I'm not interested in your suffering in any way. And that brings me, you know, we've mentioned compassion a whole lot. I'm not sure if we've asked you to define it. This is the title of your book. So how about we go there? What is compassion in
action? Yeah, but it fits well with what you just say about, you know, about current leadership. And there's also, before I define it, I would also say that, you know, some leadership positions attract people like that you just mentioned, right?
Yeah.
Narcissism, selflessness, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think good leadership is about serving and letting your ego go, right? If you can, we all have an ego, and for some of us it's bigger than others, right? But it's like, if you can kind of park that and serve people, it's a whole different exercise, I would say, to be leader.
When your leaders are elected, then you're really also talking about the culture of the people who are voting, in terms of what their values are and how that gets represented.
Yeah, that's right. And then you also, I think there's also, you know, this, what is it? What do you call that? Self-selection. I mean, it is like in the organization, you select people like yourself, and it's kind of, and I think for us, for I would call myself a compassionate leader. I try to be that, right? But that also means that sometimes we don't take the fight, right? And I think that's why it at some point it becomes a revolution, I think. But it will be a revolution of gentle giants, That's what I call it.
Yeah, I like that phrase, gentle giant. So what is, I have a two-part question, kind of what is compassion then? And what does that mean for leadership? I know you've talked a little bit about that already, but just to push you a little bit on it. Yes. And then how does that, I don't know what the right phrase is, rub or conflict with, hey, I'm in charge and I have to get these things done. And I know you might be stressed and overwhelmed and overworked, but we've got a job to do and we've got to get it done. And how do you kind of balance, you know, in organizations that are resource constrained, how do you balance those tensions?
Yeah, but I don't think there is a disconnect there. But first I'd say, so the definition of compassion is... And I know there are some definitions of compassion, but they all talk about almost the same thing. My definition in this model and with organization is an interest in other people's difficulties, and a burning desire to do something about it. Mm-hmm. I think that's real leadership. And I think leadership without compassion is at best incomplete. Sometimes I say you can't have real leadership without compassion.
There's a whole lot of morality wrapped up in that. I mean, Buddhism teaches that one of the greatest goods you can do in the world is to help resolve the suffering of someone else, help alleviate someone else's suffering. And you find similar messages in Christianity and Judaism. And so these are common threads that are really about our basic humanity and our shared humanity.
That's right, Phil. That's right. I agree, and I think just to mention that I think we talk too much about empathy as a leadership trait, because empathy can be a passive thing. I think we should talk more about compassion, because that's where there is action and compassion, of course, right? and you mentioned, how does that connect with an organization where you say, we have a job to do here, we have limited resources, and you just keep the midnight oil burning, whatever you say, something like that, right?
Yeah, because I do see, I see that tension sometimes in my own work and working with people, in that, look, I'm tired, I'm burnt out, I'm stressed, I don't want to do these extra things, but some of these things have to get done, right? And so how, I guess I'm wondering what is your advice on how you navigate that as a compassionate leader, both acknowledging that, yes, I see where you're at, and I do want to do what I can to help you and reduce that suffering, and we also need to get certain things done as an organization to survive and thrive.
Yeah, so I think there's probably many potential answers to that. I mean, and you talk about reducing the suffering. I like that. I mean, and I know where that's coming from, but I also like that approach, because that speaks to the compassionate leader, right? Mm-hmm. But I think if I'm coaching leaders that have a very performance-driven approach to leading, managing people in organization, I very, very often a good direction to take there to promote compassionate leadership is to talk about what is most effective, what is an effective leadership style. Because you want to be effective, you want to have success, and we know from research that compassion, you can call it softness or kindness, works better than toughness, right? Mm-hmm. We know that. Performance is simply better. And if you get to a point where that is understood or is at least acknowledged, then you start working on your compassionate leadership skills, right? And then, of course, I don't think that compassion is soft.
Yeah, I think it can be quite hard, actually.
Yeah, I think it's also about you. I mean, you and I, we can also have a compassion is also honesty. It's also courage.
Courage. Yeah, I was just going to say that.
And you know, courage comes from the French word that means heart. But it's also, you know, having important, tough conversation is also compassion, I think. And then sometimes we forget that in the compassionate leadership area, that compassion is not soft. It demands courage, honesty, transparency, things like that.
That's excellent. So, all right. I'm gonna hit with. Oh, do you have another question?
Go ahead. Are we running out of time? I have like 100 questions.
I know. Me too. This is good though. This is what we want, right? The fire, the passion. Yes. What was that? Now I've lost my question.
Yeah, I don't know. I was just going to say, like, you know, in the course that Phil and I teach, Phil, of course, leads Tai Chi, and I lead some surf stuff, and we take the students to go surfing. And one of the common threads between, like, surfing and Tai Chi that we often try to think about and apply to our lives and each other is this idea that you can't, you know, sometimes to that hardness, when obstacles get hard, we want to meet that hardness with more hardness. Mm. And we're banging ourselves up against a wall. And what in both the Tai Chi and the surfing, you have to sort of dance with those energies, flow with them. And that takes a kind of courageous softness, a courageous fluidity that is often counterintuitive. And I think for me, and I think a lot of our students, like, you have to sort of experience that in kind of an embodied way, whether you do it through a mindfulness practice or Tai Chi or yoga or whatever, so you can understand how can I conceptually apply this organizationally, that I just can't keep hitting hard with hard. We're all going to get smashed to bits. I don't know if there was a question in there, but I was just sparked by things you're both saying.
I love that. I agree. I think that those are also good. I don't know even if it's a metaphor, but it's just like, you know, like the embodiment, like you said. I love that. Yeah.
All right. I remembered my question.
I was tap dancing a little.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I needed the time. So there is often a disconnect between what organizations say they value and then how people are actually evaluated, the performance evaluation. So you talk about KPIs and whatnot. And I guess my question is I would say it makes logical sense. If organizational happiness, right, it does drive organizational thriving and performance in the way that all the research suggests it does, then it would naturally make sense that we would want those indicators built into how our leaders are evaluated. Right, so I'm not just evaluating you based on your number of new products and you know, your margins on this and that, but also how are you inspiring the people in your organization? And I wanted to know your thoughts about that. And are you aware of organizations that have at least talked about that? Because we talked about relationships, right? So we talked the value of teamwork, and almost every organization understands how important teamwork is. Almost no organizations actually evaluate people on teamwork. They evaluate people as individuals, right? And so if we're really about, right, if my job as a leader partly is to inspire people to get them to work together, to feel some psychological safety so they can be creative and whatnot, then those, if that's good leadership, then I think that I should be measured on that as a leader. Does that make sense?
Yeah. 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 And I think, that maybe, let me see if this answers your question, but I think, you know, you read out the 10 questions, that we have. And these 10 questions are both, I mean, if you do that on a regular basis, you measure on the 10 questions. It's really for you as a manager. What should we talk about the next time we have a team meeting, right? It's as simple as that. It's not a big evaluation or your leadership skills. It's more like, how can I, on a consistent basis, make sure that we talk about the things that are important for us? Mm-hmm. on the meetings that we're having. And it gives you a little bit of input if one of the scores dive, you probably need to address and say, what's going on here as a leader? And sometimes it's very simple. Sometimes we overcomplicate things like this. Sometimes it could be that they have fish in the canteen on Wednesdays and it smells or something. I mean, sometimes it's little things that you can fix immediately, right? It's not a big structural culture thing.
Yeah.
So that's one way, and I think also there what I see, if there is a bit of an evaluation, of course, if you have a whole organization where every team is measured on these things, for the top management, they are able to see a smoke before it becomes a fire, right? I mean, if something is declining, there's something wrong. There's something wrong with leadership here, and maybe we have to send in the HR director or someone else or a consultant or something, right? And on the other hand, you can also identify the lighthouses, which I think is we have talked about a couple of times. But if you can see departments where it's consistently scoring high, what is it that you do in that? And sometimes it's also very simple. It's how you start your meetings. Things like that. Some changing small structural things about how the language you use and things like that. So that was probably a little bit of an answer to that question.
No, I like it. It makes me think of, be familiar with the phrase small ball, baseball, kind of making huge changes in the team by focusing on all these small little things you can do. And there was a book that I think I can't remember if it was called Small Teaching or whatnot, but it was about that same thing and kind of the small things we can do in our classrooms that change the atmosphere for student learning. And I think, and I hear the same thing. I hear you saying the same thing about leadership, these small things that we can do that it can actually have really big effects.
Yeah.
Well, Lars, this conversation was no small thing. We are so grateful for you and this time. This was outstanding. Thank you so, so much for this.
Wonderful to have you on the program, so wonderful. Lars. And you know, a plug that we all have leadership roles, and I think people don't always if they don't have a formal title, sometimes they don't think they have something, right? And that's not the case. Leadership, I think, is something, you know, as a parent, right, there are leadership skills that you are executing and trying to cultivate as a friend, as someone in your community, that we all have many different roles. So to realize that this conversation, I think, applies to everyone, because we all wear many different hats.
So that leads us to your challenge this week, friends. To Phil's point, we have figuring out what your leadership role is in your variety of communities. Consider what you can do to exercise compassion in action, to be truly present for those around you, and to genuinely work to reduce their suffering. And we've talked about keeping a journal. This is an excellent opportunity to do that, to start journaling about some of these things, and see where you can start taking this compassionate action.
And that's it for this episode. Subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube and we'll be sure to respond. And be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook. If you have questions or comments, or there's a subject you'd like to hear us discuss, please reach out to thriveologylab@gmail.com. Thrive on, friends.
Thrive on.